Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
To HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Now, the first segment of our show, folks, is a post-dated interview, so some of the events referred to might already have passed. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Ann Mullen from the University of Windsor. So, what's the latest with the Accessibility Committee and any campaigns?
Well, Cam, thanks for having me in today. I wanted to highlight some of the work that some of our accessibility committees have been working on over the past year. We have 7 accessibility committees in total, which are made up of members of the university community. We have faculty members, staff, students. We even have people from the external environment, so the broader community come in and meet with our committees to talk about some items that are going on. So it's a wide representation of people across campus, and it's good because it's a shared responsibility with accessibility. So our current structure has been in effect for about 3 years, and it's moving along quite nicely. But the two projects that I wanted to highlight today are involving our Accessible Built Environment Committee and our Accessible Education Training and Awareness Committee. So our Accessible Built Environment Committee looks at the current infrastructure at the university to identify where there are barriers, and where there are barriers, how we can strategically remove those so that as we move forward, obviously there will be fewer and fewer barriers and a more accessible campus for all. With this, it's a challenge to properly prioritize projects, because the reality is there's just so many items on our current deferred maintenance list that need to be addressed. It's very costly. And how do you pick which items need to be addressed first? So what the committee's been working on for the past year is developing a priority matrix that takes into account a number of variables to help keep the decision-making impartial and choose which projects funding should be allocated to that are in the greatest need of being done. So some of the factors that we've taken into consideration include, is there a barrier right now that prevents somebody from actually being able to access a space? Or will a future barrier develop if an item is not addressed? What are some of the costs that would be involved in this? Is there a health and safety issue currently? So there's a number of factors. But then what we do is we have all of these identified barriers included on a list, and through the priority matrix we assign a numeric value to each variable, and then from there we can more objectively determine what needs to be done so that, again, we can allocate that funding. So we're really excited about that, so that we can find a more, as I say, impartial way of determining which projects need to be done and which are the greatest priority. So it's been a bit of a labor of love, but we're moving forward with this and identifying all of those barriers that exist currently.
So, to your knowledge, has any other campus of any other university attempted a matrix such as this?
Not that I'm aware of, but I know there are universities that are doing audits of the campus. So what is a trend that we're seeing is having an external auditor come in who has a lot of expertise about accessibility to identify the barriers across campus and then provide that information to the various universities. As far as I am aware, those items are not then prioritized. They're strictly identified and given to the university so they have that information. So what we're trying to do is then we have a lot of that information about where the barriers exist, but now we need to determine. The reality is there's a limited source of funding, how we allocate the funding each year so that the barriers that are the most significant or have the most impact on people, they're being addressed first, and we can move down the list to hopefully have a barrier-free university by 2025.
So in this plan, is there a time frame included, say, take this step in X amount of time?
Well, the goal that we've looked at, we've been discussed, is to have a barrier-free campus by 2025. And that really ties into the AODA's timeline of a barrier-free Ontario by 2025. So we've been trying to go off of that. We're still in the early stages of the priority matrix, so we haven't done enough work to determine how this year's project will flow into next year's project and those sorts of pieces. But, you know, as we move along and we've got something put in place, then we'll have a better understanding of that.
So in terms of these accessibility upgrades, I assume there's going to be some sort of monitoring to make sure that everything remains in operating condition.
Yes, yeah. So our maintenance department, that's part of one of the responsibilities that they have. And also, if you're talking about accessibility infrastructure that can break down, like, say, door actuators, we have a reporting mechanism in place and the information on those doors so that people know, okay, if this isn't working, you need to report it right away. So we do have that in place, but yeah. As I mentioned earlier, it's part of our deferred maintenance list, some of these projects. So that's an overall list of all of the identified issues on campus. They might not necessarily be related to accessibility. It could just be that the wear and tear on some buildings. But this is within our maintenance department's purview of monitoring to make sure that as years go by, we continue to do the upgrades that are necessary.
Well, in that sense, accessibility monitoring is kind of key, just as any other function at a university would need to be upkept, because if not, you're denying a student equal access.
Exactly. Any thoughts on this? Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Yep.
So, what are the next immediate steps for the project?
Well, our committee meets in a couple weeks, and we're going to be looking at the final matrix and then prioritizing all of those projects, as I mentioned previously, that have been identified. So putting all of that together and then submitting that information to the various committees and the senior management team so that they're aware of this so that we can move forward with a better strategy for addressing the issues.
So if you could send any one message about the importance of this, what would you say?
I think that it involves collaboration in that identifying barriers is a shared responsibility and working towards the campus to keep it accessible, because it's such a nuanced item. I mean, a new building might go up, or a change might be made to an existing building that creates a barrier to a certain population that people weren't even aware of. So communicating that to our accessibility office and to our committees is really helpful for us to know that these issues exist and that we can address them. Also with the identification, it's then undertaking the removal in a coherent and cohesive way. So we've identified these barriers. Now we have to have a plan in place so that we have the removal. And again, we can move forward to a barrier-free campus by 2025.
So what's the other component of the ongoing committee work that you wanted to talk about?
Our Accessible Education Training and Awareness Committee has been involved in a really cool initiative this past year that we're going to start getting out to the community over the next month. We had a number of students working with our committee who put together some articles about accessibility or barriers, but did it in a way that it's personal and anecdotal, so that persons who may not have an understanding of how some of these issues impact people, they can hear it firsthand. So, like, there was a really good piece that was put together about scanning PDFs. And for persons who might not be familiar with that, you say you're working on a document and you print it out and it's a Word document, but you need to have it in a PDF format. Some people might take that printed document and scan it through a photocopier and yay, now you've got a PDF copy. But for anybody who's using a screen reader, and oftentimes that's persons who have low vision or who are blind, they can no longer access that information because the photocopier just captures that document as an image and doesn't capture any of the information. So a person now who isn't aware of this didn't realize that they just created a barrier for somebody who needs to get that information. And again, it's not bad intention, it's just not being aware of it. So we put together some of this information to let people know, hey, if you need to make if somebody's requesting a PDF format, you've got to convert it electronically. So that would mean when you're actually working on the document in your computer, you would save it as PDF, and then the document is readable by somebody who's using screen reader technology. But manually scanning it in, nope, you've just created a barrier. So it's been really good that we've had the students working with us to capture some of these issues and provide the firsthand experience so that it makes it more real. And you know, the students saying that the frustration they experience because they need to get some information for, say, a course, and they're working with the same timelines as any other person in the class, and then they get the information, but they can't even access it. So, you know, these are the types of stories that resonate and stay with somebody that they're going to realize, oh, you know what, I'm not going to do that in the future because I don't want to inadvertently set up a barrier for someone. So we'll be distributing these articles across campus, and we hope to make the campus community more aware of some of these items and, again, prevent future issues from potentially happening.
Thank you very much for your help.
Thank you.
Of course. I just love to see that, folks, that the university is taking accessibility to the people, so to speak, asking what the needs really are, getting disability issues from different perspectives, finding out what really matters to the community, and then responding to it. It's an incredible thing, but a necessary one. No one can speak better to what matters to a person with a disability better than they themselves. It can be a matter of trial and error, finding out what works the best. But with time, with effort, you can make real progress. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned. The Downtown Music Initiative is providing a unique opportunity for young people to learn and to thrive from music in the community.
The DMI is a community program that offers free music lessons to students ages 4 to 17 who come from low-income families. It's run by volunteer musicians.
How can I get more information on the DMI?
You can contact me, Melissa Miner, at 226-347-6409 or visit our Facebook page, Downtown Music Initiative.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Anne Mullen from the University of Windsor. Now, this segment of our show, the activities referred to reflect those of the individual and not necessarily those of anyone at CGM 99.1. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Rich Fabend from Handy Help. So tell me a little bit about Handy Help.
Well, Handy Help is a website that I started in 2008. I had been injured in 1999, and I'd been an outdoorsman beforehand. I'd been a licensed guide in New York State, and I wanted to return to the outdoors, to hunting and fishing and kayaking. And as I began to look for stuff, there wasn't very much available, and what was available was extremely expensive. So I started quite simply to begin with, making little tools for myself, like to pick up a piece of paper or a bottle and things like that. And I developed quite a few different things. I had been involved in the martial arts before I got hurt, and with Project Adventure, which is a experiential learning technique that teaches kids to problem solve. So I knew that, you know, there were many different ways to do something. And after a number of years, I happened to be in Kingston at Motion Specialties, and I used one of my tools to do something, and the fellow asked me what it was, and I showed him, and he said to me, you know, you really should put that on a website. So I came home, and I found a free website builder, and I built my own website and put it online. And at first, it was quite small, maybe 15 or 20 things, and it's grown over the years to probably maybe 70 or 75 different things that we've come up with or modified or taken stuff made for able-bodied people and copied it. And everything on there is free. I want to spare people the having to, you know, reinvent the wheel and go through all the trials and tribulations that I did, particularly the veterans that were coming home from Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan. And so it grew, and it's been very successful. I get about 1,000 hits a day, and I think I've had something like 155 different countries on it. I put a thing on there where you can translate a page into one of, I think, maybe 70 or 75 different languages. So it's grown, and it's been very gratifying.
So have there been any challenges in the work of inventing new and better accessible products?
Sure.
So could you tell me a little bit about what challenges you've faced?
Well, I'm a C6 complete quadriplegic, so I'm paralyzed about 80% of my body. My arms function, but they don't function normally, and my hands are in a semi-fist position, so it's difficult for me to grip, and it's difficult for me, obviously, I'm in a wheelchair all the time, to pick anything up off the floor. So those were initial problems that I faced, and those were things that I solved early on. The first thing was picking a piece of paper up off the floor, and I finally came up with throwing a washer on the floor, and there's a tool called a mechanics magnet that is like a magnet at the end of an automobile antenna, the telescope. So I pull it out, slide the paper on top of the magnet, on top of the washer, and then stick the washer on the paper and the magnet, and stick the magnet on the paper and the washer adheres to it, and I picked it up. And other things took me years to return to hunting. How do you camouflage a wheelchair? And I ended up using snow fence and putting camouflage on it and make it a permanent spot. I developed a extremely inexpensive adaption, probably cost $1 or $1.50, that allows me to fire my weapon using my mouth. And all of those different problems, it 11 years to figure everything out. And finally, I harvested my first turkey, and since then, I've harvested four more. And, you know, it would have been easy to give up and throw in the sponge, but when I talk to groups, I talk about persistence. I talk about looking at failure as an opportunity for growth, as not as an end in itself. And some projects I have to walk away from for a while, and because I get so frustrated, but I always come back to them, and I'm constantly reevaluating and making products more usable by adding things to them, and it's just been, you know, I just keep after things, and I tell people I think attitude is far more important than ability. And you talk about things that I had to deal with. I think in the beginning, a lot of people, including myself, concentrated on my disability as opposed to my ability. And I read a quote a long time ago from Christopher Reeve that said, I refuse to allow a disability to determine how I will live my life. And I realized that what he really was talking about was attitude. And so I began to develop that attitude, and I have a blog where I talk a lot, particularly in the beginning, about the importance of attitude. And I really think anybody can develop that attitude if they work on it and practice, and I call it learned empowerment, that, you know, you can empower yourself and solve most of the challenges and frustrations that you face.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Whether or not you approve of the sport of hunting, you must admit the technology, the advancements, the innovation are quite fascinating. The fact is, it takes a creative mind to come up with the next great advancement for a person with a disability. But what Rich did to share those at no cost and to save people the long distance runaround, as it were, is really an amazing thing. Because when it comes to disability innovations, the worst thing any of us can do is keep it to ourselves, to say, yes, this is good for me, but the rest of you, figure it out yourselves. That does not foster advancement or that all-important sense of community in disability life. I've said it a million times, disability life is about learning from each other's ideas, about playing off each other's skills, and yes, even making use of some of the great advancements that are being made. And what Rich has done is taken his abilities, what he still can do, and saying, this is what I can do. How can I translate that into doing what I want to do? He's taken what most people would consider impossible to be done and finding a way. That, too, was the key in disability life. To say, I'm not going to be just the medical model. I'm not just a set of symptoms. I'm not just the result of an incident. I am a person with the potential to learn, grow, advance, and create. And as long as that potential thrives in me, I will achieve. I will do something extraordinary. For a person with a disability, it doesn't seem like something so amazing, at least not all the time. It can seem like simply getting to where they want to be. I heard the expression once, if you need a hammer and you don't have one, use a pipe. That is one of the statements that sticks out the most in disability life for me. For a person who just wants to get down the street to the corner store, and they have to go through an inaccessible street, finding a way to do that, it's not so they can be extraordinary in the community. It's not so they can say, hey, look what I did. It's necessity. It's achieving their own goal. And yes, in many cases, people will look at it and say, this is a remarkable accomplishment. Because they're doing something society just doesn't expect. Society should never underestimate people with disabilities. They should never say something cannot be done, cannot be achieved. Because Rich's work is really the perfect demonstration that adaptations can be made. The possibilities do exist. The only question that really matters is, are we as a society willing to look, willing to say, this is what this person's experimenting with. Can it work? Or are we just going to dismiss the possibility outright? Keeping an open mind can free a person in a way you can't even imagine. If Rich's mind is open to saying, yes, this can work, odds are he'll find a way to do it. The belief that something can be achieved is the starting place. When it is achieved is the end of the journey. But between that, all it takes is motivation, support, and asking the right questions. I want to emphasize support in that statement, because nobody, whether they have a disability or not, gets through this life all on their own. And learning from each other's ideas, learning from the technology, the policies that do exist, helps us to build on them, helps us to understand what the foundation is, and ask ourselves, how do we take it to the next level? What can we do to make this shine just a little bit brighter? And that is what disability adaptations are all about. Making life shine. Giving an opportunity where there wasn't one before. Saying to yourself, this is what exists, it's fine, it's good, but I think we can do even better. That's what I love about disability innovations. They're always adapting, they're always growing. It's always a matter of somebody saying, can we make this safer? Can we make this more agile? Can we come up with a better policy? Now that's something that I went into fairly heavily in a recent episode, in that the MS Society is doing a lot of government lobbying to try to make better policies. The existing ones don't provide enough, in their opinion. Recognizing that we can do better means you get that message out there. You talk to people. You say, do you agree with me, or do you have a reason thinking this is the best we can do? And if so, I want to hear about it. It's up to everyone to keep an open mind, not just members of the disability community. Their support people, their advocates, they all must be willing to ask, is this all there is, or is there something more we can do? And that is how progress begins, my friends. Never, ever accept that an adaptation or an innovation cannot be made, that there is absolutely no way to achieve. No person is beyond hope. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.